from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you've been following the news, you know that New Orleans, Louisiana, whence this show is originating today again, has had, I think it's fair to say, more than its share of assaults from outside forces. There was the man-made levee failure that caused the flooding in 2005, about which, if you're still not up to speed, the big uneasy comes out this August. There was the arrival of Ed Blakely, the recovery czar. There's the current oil thing, and now, and we could see this coming, couldn't we? Come on. Yes, we could. Now there's this. For more than a year, the local chapter of Habitat for Humanity has insisted there were no defects in the Chinese drywall it used to build nearly 400 houses for victims of the flood, including many in the heavily publicized Musician's Village in the Upper Ninth Ward. Yes, there's an Upper Ninth Ward, ladies and gentlemen, despite what you've heard. A house-by-house canvas of Musician's Village by reporters from the Sarasota Herald Tribune and the ProPublica nonprofit news service found several homeowners who reported serious problems, and one who said she had complained to Habitat for more than a year about corrosion and electronics failures believed to be related to her Chinese drywall. The reporters' interviews with dozens of residents also turned up a second potentially significant problem. Some of the homes that Habitat officials believed had been built with American-made drywall actually contain a Chinese product instead. But that's just as good, isn't it? As a result, Habitat has begun investigating as many as 50 post-Katrina homes that use the allegedly American-made product. Most of the targeted homes are in Musician's Village, largely bankrolled by Harry Connick Jr. and Branford Marsalis. Hey, Bran. Hey, BM. In an attempt to bring musicians back to the city after the hurricane. But some are in other New Orleans neighborhoods. A Habitat spokeswoman said the investigation has already confirmed that 5 houses have Chinese drywall and are exhibiting problems associated with the product, such as corroded electrical wiring. That couldn't lead to anything bad. The New Orleans chapter continued using Chinese drywall in the village and its other New Orleans projects throughout 2009, long after other builders stopped because it said it had done tests showing that the stockpile of Chinese product it bought from Taishan Gypsum in March 2007 was not problematic. As to those tests, the testing method used by the company Habitat hired has since been discredited. Instead of testing a sample of the actual drywall, you'd think that would be the thing. It's commonly done. The company tested the air in a warehouse where the drywall was stored and the air in a volunteer center where the drywall was installed. It's close. It's almost testing the drywall. It's this close. We're also sampling the waters where the Gulf used to be in a related development. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has received more than 3,300 complaints from 37 states about the bad drywall. Several brands of Chinese drywall, including several varieties of Taishan, emit large amounts of sulfur gases that may trigger respiratory problems and cause refrigerators, air conditioners, and other electronic products to fail. The only way to fix a house with contaminated drywall, according to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, is to remove both the wallboard and the electrical wiring. That'll be fun. This time of year, good project to take on. New Orleans area Habitat spokeswoman Alexis Tusa? It says here Elise, but I bet there's an X in there. Anyway, she wouldn't say whether the nonprofit plans to make those repairs. She also indicated Habitat officials have no plan to systematically inspect the 200 houses it built with Chinese drywalls, which Habitat officials still insist is not defective. She says the focus now is on determining how many of the 50 homes Habitat built with what it thought was American board actually contained the bad drywall. You sit in the corner. Just another thing happening here. Another one of those little rain clouds. And now, ladies and gentlemen, AFAC! News of AFAC! And there'll be more, because in the rush to discuss AFPAC today on the Sunday Yak shows. An astonishing omission, but we'll get to that. First, Britain's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, who has criticized elements of the U.S. war strategy, has resigned. And the new government of Prime Minister Cameron is reviewing whether to fill the job. Yeah, why would you need a special representative for AFPAC? Sherrard Cowper-Coles, the British counterpart of Richard Holbrooke, has held the position since early 2009. He was formerly ambassador to Afghanistan. He pushed for a political solution in Afghanistan and for higher priority to be given to talks with the Taliban, while expressing skepticism that increased military force could prevail. Oh, stay tuned. He's not the only one. Cowper-Coles drew attention in 2008 when he was quoted in a leaked French diplomatic cable as criticizing President Karzai and the Bush administration and advising his government to tell the United States that, quote, we want to be part of a winning strategy, not a losing one, unquote. At an international conference on Afghanistan held in London in January, Britain pressed Karzai to speed up efforts to hold reconciliation talks with the insurgents, a direction the Obama administration has grown more comfortable with. Do you see the race to the exits? Do you see the ghost of Teddy Kennedy haunting the Obama administration regarding the July 2011 beginning of the seriously thinking about the beginning of the withdrawing of the drawdown of the thing? Also, news of AFPAC, use of opiate drugs such as heroin and opium has doubled in Afghanistan since 2005, with nearly 3% of Afghan adults now addicted, according to the UN. This, ladies and gentlemen, is measurable progress. If we get the whole country addicted to their own, the drug they grow, then there's a healthy cycle of they grow what they don't know. The data suggested that even as the U.S. and its allies have poured billions into programs to try to wean the Afghan economy off drug money, opium and heroin have become more entrenched in the lives of ordinary Afghans, creating another barrier to international efforts to knock out support for the trade that fuels the Taliban. This war on drugs thing is working even when there's a war. It's kooky. The human face of Afghanistan's drug problem is not only seen on the streets of Moscow, London, or Paris, it's in the eyes of its own citizens, says Antonio Maria Costa, head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. Well done, sir. Some Afghan addicts say they started using drugs to blunt the agonies of the grinding war. In some areas, users also give opium to their children to quiet them. I've always wondered, when I'm flying, why parents don't give their crying babies opium. Just ask the Afghans. And, ladies and gentlemen, the quote of the week this week comes from Rupert Murdoch. Good lesson for all of us here. He's no fan of the Obama energy policy. He says, sure, we should be investing in solar, wind power and the like, but he said there's still going to be a place for coal, oil and natural gas for the foreseeable future. The U.S., he says, should be building pipelines to bring some of those fuels from Alaska to the lower 48. And he added, quote, we didn't buy Alaska to protect the moose, unquote. The quote of the week to Rupert Murdoch. Sir, you deserve it. Hello, welcome to the show. From the shores of Lake Pontchartrain, New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And I stand corrected. I correct myself because rain clouds here we look forward to because it means it'll cool down a little bit. So those aren't rain clouds, ladies and gentlemen. There's something far worse. Now,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector. General
news,
oh, yeah,
of the inspectors general. Ladies and gentlemen, while federal mine safety regulators last year were curtailing tougher enforcement actions because of, quote, resource limitations, that means money, the Obama administration was telling Congress it had enough money to do the job. It's the left hand and the right hand. We need a third hand. That's what I propose a third hand. Last week, the Department of Labor Inspector General revealed that the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration excluded some potentially dangerous mines from review for patterns of violation enforcement orders. So, not just one violation, a pattern, but they're okay. In March 2009, MSHA, Coal Administrator Kevin Strickland instructed his staff to consider only one mine per field office and three per district office for those orders, which put operators in line for tougher sanctions. As a result, at least 10 mines with a history of repeated violations were not examined more closely and considered for those tougher sanctions. Inspector General Elliot Lewis said his investigators discovered that MSHA officials, that's Mine Safety and Health Administration, officials believed this guidance was necessary to address resource limitations, i.e., lack of funds. But 2 months later, President Obama proposed a modest budget increase for MSHA, and Labor Secretary Hilda Solis said publicly the president's budget proposal was adequate for MSHA to do its job. The third hand. That's what we need. The Environmental Protection Agency is 10 years behind schedule in setting guidelines for a host of toxic air pollutants, according to a report from the agency's inspector general. The report was released last week. It found the agency had failed to develop emission standards due in, 2000, for some sources of hazardous air pollutants. These included smaller sites often located in urban areas like dry cleaners and gas stations, but also some chemical manufacturers. Hey, it's just chemistry. We're all chemistry, you know? The inspector general also found the agency had not met targets outlined in a 1999 planning document, the Integrated Urban Air Toxic Strategy, including tracking urban dwellers' risk of developing health problems from exposure to pollutants. Some experts said the failures, it's Abby Hoffman, I believe, who defined an expert as a talkative guy from out of town. Some experts said the failures were persisting largely because the EPA's Office of Air and Radiation, which is responsible for regulating air pollutants, lacked the money needed to meet its deadlines. It's a resource problem. Just take it from the third hand. In a written response to the report, EPA officials also said budget cuts had made it difficult to meet their deadlines, noting that air toxic support has been cut over 70% since 2001. Gee, what was happening since 2001? In the past, the Government Accountability Office has found that the low priority for the air toxics program and limited financing were in part to blame for the agency's failure to stay on schedule. News. Oh, one more. The majority of clinical trials. No, it's not OJ and MJ. No, you know, for drugs. Clinical trials used to support drug approvals in the United States. The majority of these tests, they're tests, ladies and gentlemen, are conducted now, where do you think? Colorado? Missouri? Montana? How about outside the United States, where inspection is rare and standards may be lax? A new report from the Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General reveals that for drugs approved in 2008, 80% of the applications for approval contained data from foreign clinical trials. Over half the subject in trials were located outside the U.S., most in Western Europe. Okay. Italians. French. I'm fine with that. The report is heightening concerns about the ever-increasing move of trials into countries where costs are lower and regulation is seen as lighter. Central and South America, Eastern Europe, and Asia also account for a significant number of clinical trials identified in the report.
Yeah.
But those are the countries that are winning at the World Cup. As sponsors increase the number of foreign clinical trials in support of FDA marketing applications, the agency's current method of using inspections to ensure human subject protections and data validity is becoming increasingly strained, says the report. The FDA inspects 1.9% of domestic clinical trials. It checked up on only 0.7% of the foreign trials. The FDA conducted no inspections at all in 10 countries that accounted for nearly 50,000 clinical trial patients. Ken Johnson, Senior Vice President of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, denies there's anything wrong in the use of foreign clinical trials. The same strict regulatory standards apply to foreign trials as trials conducted domestically, he said in a statement. You know, I believe him. I like the looks of his statement. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I think after that, one needs some inspiration, some sense of a greater purpose, some sense of unity among all peoples around the world. That's right. The Olympic movement. Oh, sure, the World Cup seems like it's... But no, it's the Olympics. This week, no, not stories of heroic devotion to years of training. This week, it's devotion to the money. But such devotion. Dateline Lausanne, Switzerland. The International Olympic Committee is holding off negotiating the next round of U.S. television rights and could delay the high-stakes bidding again until next year because of the fragile state of the American economy and, hence, weakness in the advertising market. Richard... I don't write him. I just read him. Richard Carrion. Yes, spelled exactly that way. The IOC official who handles the TV negotiations said in an interview that the unfavorable financial climate makes it unwise to seek a deal now with U.S. broadcasters for the 2014 and 2016 Olympic Games. We're in no hurry yet, says Carrion. It's more the economic environment that shapes these things. When all that translates into some optimism on the part of advertisers, I think we'll make our move. By this time, in the last four-year cycle, the IOC had already wrapped up two-thirds of its TV dollar revenues. This time, it's only about 10%. The U.S. negotiations were already postponed last year because of the global financial crisis. Carrion is a banking... Oh, sorry, it would be Carrion, since he's a banking executive from Puerto Rico. Says there's been only informal contact with the broadcasters. We say hello, he said. But wait. He does say, we'll see how it plays out. It's a deal that's about content, so I can only see positive things from our point of view. We think we have probably the most valuable piece of sports content on the planet. But wait, there's more. Sports fans who want to use a credit or debit card to buy tickets for the London Olympics will be restricted to using a Visa card due to an exclusive deal between Olympic organizers and Visa. On the official London ticket site, it says, in recognition of Visa's support of the Olympic Games, 2012 London is proud to accept only Visa cards. Sponsor support is crucial to the staging of the Olympics and the operation of organizations throughout the Olympic movement. The restrictions apply only to UK cardholders. Non-UK cardholders will still be able to use whatever card they like. And the International Olympic Committee has said it is constantly on the lookout for any ambush marketing tactics that may be adopted at the 2012 Olympics. Following FIFA's strong reaction to a bevy of beer-promoting orange miniskirt-wearing women during the World Cup. The British government has already introduced legislation which prohibits companies using any combination of words like Olympics, London, 2012, or gold, with a more detailed list of prohibited activities expected later this year. London Olympic Games patrons will be banned from wearing garments with advertising logos. That'll be easy. The Olympic Games differ from the World Cup in that Olympic venues are free of all advertising. It's a movement, ladies and gentlemen, and we all need one every day. So, you know, it's the dedication that I think remains with me after all the money. You, too? Yeah, really? Yeah, okay, good. The guy with the leg and the thing and the sister that didn't, you know, go to school. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's cheap, it's too safe to meter, it's nuclear power. Dateline Trenton, New Jersey, in a rare rebuke, federal officials criticized the New Jersey State Police for mistakes they made last month during an emergency drill at the Salem Hope Creek nuclear plant in southern New Jersey. During a simulated nuclear disaster, now when would that ever happen? A nuclear disaster. No, they simulated it. It took the state police 62 minutes to inform the public within 60 miles of the reactors whether to evacuate or seek nearby shelter. About 17 minutes too long for FEMA, which said the response was seriously deficient. The state police were also cited for identifying the wrong town in a press release warning local officials about potentially contaminated fish in this simulated disaster. The test will be rerun on July 15th. Get it right this time, Jersey, please. The federal government tests nuclear emergency preparedness and response every 2 years for the area within 10 miles of the plant and every 6 years for a 60-mile radius because it's so safe. They do that for everything, don't they? They do that for... Worsening shortages of staff and funds could jeopardize the safety of Britain's Trident nuclear weapons, according to the British Ministry of Defense. In an informal safety report just released under Freedom of Information Law, the Ministry of Defense says it's facing increasing difficulties managing its nuclear program with due regard for the protection of the workforce, the public, and the environment. Experts fear the outcome could be disastrous. They point out that the Ministry of Defense has already run into major problems with decommissioning defunct nuclear submarines and with leaks from its aging radioactive waste facilities in Gar Loch in Scotland. This really is rapidly tipping into a calamitous situation. Calamitous situation, says John Large, a leading nuclear consultant, speaking to the Herald of Scotland. The Ministry of Defense's entire safety system is under-resourced, outdated, and largely unaccountable, he alleges. The Ministry of Defense's blunt warning comes in a report produced last year by the internal body charged with overseeing the safety of all military activities. The primary concern was the pressure that resource constraints are placing on safety. There were concerns over the adequacy of resources available to deliver and regulate the defense nuclear programs safely. There is no immediate concern. The report warned of a risk it will become increasingly difficult to maintain. The nuclear defense programs are being managed with due regard for the protection of the workforce, the public, and the environment. A clear sign of the difficulties are the deteriorating plans for managing radioactive waste at Faslane, which has led to leaks into the lake, or loch, in recent years. It's just a lake. Government safety watchdogs have warned that the facilities will become unsafe in 2014, so they should be replaced by then, but according to a report to Parliament this past week, this deadline will be missed. Back here, Vermont Yankee officials say a plant design flaw is largely to blame for that tritium leak we've been talking about, discovered this past winter. The company issued a detailed report on the cause and cleanup and now claims to be an industry leader in dealing with leaks. Just a design flaw. Nothing to look at here. Representative Paul Hodes, Democrat of New Hampshire, said in response to the news that a tritium leak discovered at Vermont Yankee was located in a portion of the plant that had gone uninspected for nearly 40 years. He says inadequate oversight has allowed safety problems we're forced to deal with today to go unchecked for four decades. It's long past time for Entergy to take responsibility for its failure to reassure families living near the plant and stop the growing number of leaks. But he's a politician. Vermont Yankee officials say that two new cracks have been found and repaired in a rebuilt tower that cools water from the plant. The cracks were found June 17th and were not publicly reported by the plant. And Dateline Lacey on the Jersey Shore, a coalition of environmental groups say two recently released documents show that tritium leaks, same old tritium, our old friend tritium, at the Oyster Creek generating station were caused in part by failures by the plant's owner to submit correct documents to support its license renewal application and a federal agency's failure to review those documents adequately. That's all. It's clean. It's safe. It's so very cheap. It is nuclear power. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you're wondering about the status of seafood along the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of the oil, you know, they've been doing research. Our friends in the petroleum industry have been doing research on oil and seafood, at least oysters, for years, it turns out. This, from a very informative film called Progress Parade, produced by our friends in the petroleum industry decades ago.
Every possibility was explored. After years of study and progress, the results were in. The test oysters showed no ill effects from oil, even under conditions which far exceeded those ever present during oil production. As a matter of fact, the test oysters were so happy, they brought forth new generations to share their luck. They never had it so good. These major conclusions of the oyster research program are cheerfully turned over to the oyster industry. Why, you may ask? Why were the results of $2 million worth of research given to the oyster industry? It's because oil companies believe that maintaining good neighbors is just good business. As long as business and industry are free to lend a helping hand to each other, then everyone benefits.
Who could argue with that? Now, ladies and gentlemen, now that we've made the oysters happy and cheerfully turned over the results, back to a subject that I was... Fascinated by on this program for the last couple weeks, which is the British media's prickly insistence on taking offense at any suggestion in this country that BP is a British company. And, you know, we heard all the, all the stock owners in America and all the employees in America. But then when they were hiding BP behind Grandma's pension, it was British grandma's. However, that wasn't persuasive enough for some people. So here, David Cameron, new British Prime Minister, visiting Canada for the G8 and G20 talks. I'm betting on the 20 because there's more of them. And here he is giving his first interview to a Canadian broadcaster since becoming Prime Minister. And just pay attention to what the Canadian broadcaster and David Cameron say about what kind of company BP is.
BP is not the British government, but BP is British. And there has been a lot of tough talk in the United States about BP as a result of the oil spill. How damaging has this been for Britain?
I don't think it's been damaging for Britain. It clearly is damaging for BP, which is an important British company, and I want it to be a strong and stable company for the future. And the view I take is that BP itself wants to cap the well, clean up the spill, compensate those that have had damages. It wants to do those things. It will do those things. But I want to work with everyone concerned to try and make sure that out of all this, there will still be a strong and stable BP because it's an important company for all of us. You know, it's heartbreaking to see. This is an environmental catastrophe. Make no mistake about it. We should feel sympathy and understanding for people who are suffering in that way. And I know that BP feel like that too, that they want to pay out money. They're putting aside money. But I think it's also in all our long-term interests to make sure that there's some clarity, some finality to all of this, so that we don't, at the same time, see the destruction of a company that is important for all our interests.
They're putting aside money because they feel sympathy, not because it was a shakedown, because it's an important British company that, when you look back in history, you realize they only want to make oysters happy. Well, I heard it from the beginning. This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, in the discussion about David Petraeus, General David Petraeus, replacing General Stanley McChrystal, the cliche now has been, well, you know, Petraeus succeeded in Iraq. So let's go back to the new Iraq for a moment. A wave of fury has erupted across Iraq as its sweltering summer begins. Most people are having to deal with electricity shortages that have them or leave them with no respite from the heat and no water when their household electric pumps shut off. 7 years after the invasion, Iraqis are taking to the streets to demand basic services they have not received despite many promises and the expenditure of billions of dollars by the U.S. and Iraqi governments. The anger has forced the hand of Electricity Minister Karim Wahid. He resigned this week, this according to the Washington Post. He said the ministry could not keep up with demand and did not have enough money, adding the situation was out of its control. Prime Minister Maliki defended his government. He blamed Iraqis for consuming too much electricity. He also warned Iraqis should expect power cuts for 2 more years. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. And now, news from outside the bubble. Well, BP must be a British company because its embattled boss, Tony Hayward, is touring investors in the city of London, not New York, in an attempt to restore his tattered reputation and secure the future of the company. A series of crucial meetings with shareholders have been arranged for Hayward to explain how BP can cope with the thing. He says he has no intention of stepping down and is spelling out his long-term strategy to pay for the cleanup and for the future of the company. One big investor says Hayward appears to have bounced back from his appearance in front of a congressional committee. He was very impressive. He has 2 years to sort out the compensation fund and the sale of assets. There's no huge urgency. He's planning for the future, and we will support him. His meetings in the city of London came a day after he held a series of town hall meetings at BP's UK offices to tell employees the company was recovering, though still in intensive care. He'll be having those in Houston, won't he? Because it's an American company, too. Speaking of the G8 and the G20 meetings in Toronto, the leaders at the family photo at the G8 summit stood atop a platform wrapped with artificial grass with a stylized G8 logo in the center. A resident of the area, Lisa O'Doherty, told the Toronto Canadian Press that she found it odd that organizers deemed it necessary to install a fake grass platform on top of real grass. But if it was in the name of beautifying her already picturesque town, so much the better. And the $6,000 to $8,000 it cost to put in the artificial grass is a fraction of the $57,000 that was spent on the fake lake and artificial oasis in the International Media Center in Toronto to give journalists who are covering the Huntsville summit from a distance a taste of what it's like out there. Fake lake, fake grass at the G8 and G20. A study reported in the London Telegraph has found that long-term memory remains unaffected with age and that a person's vocabulary, emotional intelligence, and social skills may all get better. Short-term memory, learning skills, and the ability to reason do decline with age, the research shows, but not all mental faculties reach their peak when a person is in their 20s, as is commonly believed. So, you young whippersnappers, you get off my lawn. It may be, maybe wisdom. Ladies and gentlemen, may indeed be wisdom. More news from outside the bubble as the program continues, stumbles on from New Orleans. An abortion hotline, which has been set up in Pakistan, is facing violent opposition. Islamic groups and political parties have condemned the hotline, which was launched this week. It is set up by a coalition of women's groups in Pakistan and the Dutch pro-choice group Women on Waves. It advises women on how to use a drug to induce miscarriage safely and aims to reduce the estimated 890,000 unsafe illegal abortions performed in Pakistan every year. But says the head of the Muslim League, this could create misuse. It cannot be done as free choice under our law and our religion. So you see, we have more in common with Pakistan than we think, ladies and gentlemen. They really are our friends. And now, according to The Independent, on Sunday, Stanley McChrystal issued a devastatingly critical assessment of the Afghanistan war against a resilient and growing insurgency, quotes, just days before being forced out. Using confidential military documents, copies of which have been seen by The Independent on Sunday, the general briefed defense ministers from NATO and the coalition earlier this month and warned them not to expect any progress in the next 6 months. During his presentation, he raised serious concerns over levels of security, violence, and corruption within the Afghan administration. The campaign overview left behind by General McChrystal warned that only a fraction of the areas key to long-term success are secure, governed with full authority, or enjoy sustainable growth. He warned of a critical shortage of essential military trainers needed to build up Afghan forces, of which only a fraction are classified as effective. He pinpointed an ineffective or discredited Afghan government and a failure by Pakistan to curb insurgent support as critical risks to success. Waning political support and a divergence of coalition expectations and campaign timelines are key challenges faced, according to the general. Interesting that all the conversation on the Sunday Yak shows about the future of Afghanistan and under General Petraeus didn't happen to mention that closing summary of the scene by General McChrystal on his way out. Isn't that interesting? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. What was it like inside that office at the White House when General McChrystal met President Obama this week for 20 minutes? Very little reporting has come out, so might as well make something up.
The president will see you now, sir. Hello, General McChrystal.
Mr. President, have you been working out? My God, I run 4 miles a day. I thought I was fit.
Well, I have been able to play a few rounds of golf lately.
And I don't want to alarm you, sir, but isn't that Miss America walking through the hallway? Such charm, such poise. But does the Secret Service know about this? You know you can never be too safe, sir, in this time.
That was my wife heading back to the East Wing. Sit down, General.
Thank you, sir. But are you sure that wasn't Miss America? I mean, she had such youthful warmth, such...
General, we're here to talk about you.
Of course, sir. And speaking just for myself, I just have to say, I've never seen the Oval Office looking more perfectly oval. Bravo, sir. Well done.
Thanks. Now, General, there's this little matter of the interview in Rolling Stone. I'm sure you were tired after a long war.
Yes, sir.
But these kinds of comments seem to represent an ingrained disrespect for the civilian part of your chain of command. That's a serious matter.
Of course it would be, sir, but the staff and I thought it reflected the sort of camaraderie, the joie de guerre, if you will, of our relationship, as a matter of fact. Was it Dave Petraeus himself who said it? I can't remember. I've been so busy harvesting people. But someone said he thought it showed a sign of deep maturity that you could take that kind of good-natured ribbing and just keep on leading us into the future,
General,
a future bright with the promise of little children playing with butter...
General, nobody thought it came across as good-natured ribbing. It was resentful, dismissive, and contemptuous.
Oh, I'm sure you're right, sir, and yet I can't help being reminded right now, sitting here with you and Miss America, the First Lady, of how resentful and dismissive and what was the other...
Contemptuous.
Right, the ribbing that Abbott used to give to Costello, and yet I don't know about you, sir, but underneath it I always felt the deep respect that Bud had for...
General, the media don't seem to view it as playful or fun or reflecting any kind of respect. So let's take their word for it, shall we?
Yes, sir, Mr. President, of course.
Good.
Sir, although I have to say, I always told my men when the media were depicting you in the middle of the healthcare fight as weak and vacillating, I said, no, men, don't cave into the natural human tendency to believe what the media says. Mm-hmm. They're sensationalizing our strong, determined, resolute president
right,
just to sell papers and get ratings. But
right,
yes, sir, I'll stand corrected on the media, sir. After all, it really is like the old Smuckers thing, isn't it, sir?
The Smuckers thing?
Yes, sir. With a name like Wolf Blitzer, you have to tell the truth.
All right, fine. So, now the question before us. What do I do about this situation? What action do I take? Well, now, on the one hand...
Sir, if I may, I've taken the liberty of outlining several alternative courses of action you could choose from. These are just some strategic possibilities my staff and I worked up over the weekend on the new iPad CENTCOM just sent us, sir, which, by the way, I know sometimes military procurement can be a pain in the A double snakes, but if we'd had the iPad at HQ 7 years ago, we'd be out of Afghanistan long...
All right, General, let's hear your suggested courses of action.
Thank you, sir. And these aren't written in stone, of course, sir. Your people can tweak them and, you know, whatever...
Let's just hear them, please. We just have 20 minutes.
First, a complete and final banning of all reporters from the headquarters area of the war effort,
which is totally impractical.
Oh, I was just going to say exactly those words, sir,
well, but...
I was outquicked by my commander-in-chief. But a complete and final ban on all reporters from Rolling Stone. So now you've really put your finger on the problem and you've squashed it like so many unfortunate civilians, sir.
General, yes, Rolling sir. Stone has done their hit piece. They're not coming back.
Yes, sir.
What else?
Well, you could put me on, and I hesitate to say these words, sir, because you know how single-mindedly I'm dedicated to warfighting, mm-hmm, sir, but mm-hmm. You could put me on temporary leave, send me to Pearl Harbor or CENTCOM headquarters in Tampa, totally out of the action, totally removed from
someplace quiet and sunny.
Sir, is that what you think? You think my staff and I are suggesting you give me a paid vacation on the backs of the hard-working Americans who play by the rules? All right, sir, you're right. I agree. Oh. Send me off for 2 weeks in Nome. Why didn't I think of that? What's the matter with me? Bad general. Bad general.
General, we're not sending you off to Nome.
Yes, sir. I agree. Too soft. Ketchikan, sir? I could build it there with an old army buddy, Doug Dimmeldorf.
What?
Runs a salmon boning facility up there, sir. Very Spartan. Really do me good. Might teach me a lesson, sir.
You're not going to build it with Doug Dimmeldorf, General.
No, sir.
You're going to be removed from your post. It would be an unmistakable signal of weakness on my part to leave you in charge. We know that. The polls tell us that.
Yes, sir. I'm sure the men can carry on without me. Mm-hmm. Best thing for them, really. Mm-hmm. To try to conduct a sophisticated counterinsurgency operation on their own. Because really, you know, at some point you really do have to take the training wheels off the bicycle, don't you, sir? You know, let the kids take a crack at it. What do we have to lose, really?
And you'll be replaced by General Petraeus.
Dave!
Mm-hmm.
Good choice, sir. Get him back in the field before he gets any more cobwebs from that desk job, sir. Of course, he'll need me for a few months to get him up to...
General, you're dismissed from your post as of now. That is all.
Yes, sir. Spoken like a true commander, sir. I give you that. All right, sir. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, sir, it was my pleasure to kill myself and my country just to be thrown away like an old snot rag, sir.
No.
Oh, look! Miss America is still there, sir. Maybe we should ask her what she would...
Goodbye, General.
What would you do if I told you some things aren't worth anything? And would your world turn, or would you stand by everything that you believe in? You're living on what went before you. It's something that we all do. Don't leave it too late to find out, to sort out the stranger who's inside. There are no straight roads to happiness. The road must bend. And there is no one path to seek the truth. Each path must end somewhere. And I tell you, 'cause I love you, and you're hurting again. 'Cause I'm your best, best. There are no straight roads to happiness. The road must bend. And there is no one path to seek the truth. Each path must end somewhere. I tell you, 'cause I love you, and we're hurting again. 'Cause I'm your best, your best friend. Your best friend. And what would you do if I told you? What would you do if I told you some things aren't worth anything at all.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Colorado Rockies officials have apologized to a couple after the way they were treated by ushers for breastfeeding at Coors Field. Sandy Snow said she moved to an empty row to nurse her baby in private. She said only her Stella's toes were exposed. Ushers suggested she move elsewhere, like the family restroom. Said Snow, I don't eat in a bathroom and I wouldn't expect my daughter to. I really thought that was a ridiculous suggestion. One usher expressed concern that cameras might capture her breastfeeding her child. Rockies management apologized to Sandy. The letter states the staff has received training on how to provide alternate areas if the mother would like. Dateline Morgantown, West Virginia, though he believes West Virginia will end up in litigation with the EPA over tough new standards for mine permits, the state's top environmental official apologized this week for saying federal regulators would, quote, pay the price for illegal or unfair enforcement. Val Kilmer apologized to New Mexico this week, and the state forgives him by approving his hard-fought guest house permit. Ooh, quid pro apology. Kilmer apologized for his disparaging comments about his home state, calling the growing rift a misunderstanding and vowing to do whatever it takes to put it all in the past. I have the same concerns as anyone else when you hear negative things about a place you love, he told the AP. That's the good part of the story. Really, they care about where they live, and I do too. I share their concerns. He had told Rolling Stone in 2003 that he lived in, quote, the homicide capital of the Southwest and that 80% of the people in my county are drunk. Following the apology, commissioners approved a permit for Kilmer to open 3 guest houses for paying customers at his ranch. Nice. Canada's Prime Minister apologized to the families of the victims of the 1985 Air India bombing for authorities' failure to stop the single worst act of terrorism in Canadian history. Prime Minister Stephen Harper spoke at a memorial ceremony. I stand before you to offer, on behalf of the government of Canada and all Canadians, an apology for the institutional failings of 25 years ago and the treatment of the victims' families thereafter, he said. Commission of Inquiry set up to delve into the disaster last week faulted Canadian security agents for a cascading series of mishaps. Various institutions and organizations did not fulfill their responsibilities. Error, incompetence, and institutional occurred before the Air India flight and in the aftermath during the investigation and legal proceedings. Failings included those by the Mounties and the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. There was a great deal of intelligence available to them both before the bombing that should have called for enhanced security procedures and vigilance, said the report. So it's not just us, ladies and gentlemen. The Subway sandwich chain apologized for a salmonella outbreak in central Illinois and said it is working with public health officials to pinpoint the source of the contamination. I'd look at the food. Kellogg, speaking of food, has issued a voluntary product recall of 28 million boxes of some of its popular cereal brands. And the CEO says we apologize to our consumers and our customers. It says that. And are working diligently to ensure that the affected products are rapidly removed from the marketplace. Former Representative J.D. Hayworth, who's challenging John McCain in the Republican primary, has now apologized for his appearance in a 2007 infomercial for a company's questionable seminars promoting free government money. Toyota Motor Company President Akio Toyoda bowed deeply and apologized to shareholders this week for the troubles caused by the massive global recalls of the company's vehicles. British Airways has compensated a passenger who was humiliated over its policy of not allowing single male flyers to sit next to solo child travelers on its planes. I guess that must be a British company. Says B. I don't know what else that would mean. Brooklyn? General Stanley McChrystal extended his sincerest apology for the Rolling Stones profile. And the Pittsburgh Pirates rehired one of their racing pierogi mascots after management determined they should not have been fired for posting a disparaging remark about the team on the internet. The mascot, Andrew Kurtz, said he apologized to the team's mascot coordinator. So he has now been returned to his job as the racing pierogi. And Dave Weigel, formerly columnist, blogger for the Washington Post on the subject of the conservative movement, has apologized for emailed snarky comments that were made public this week that caused him, just like General McChrystal, to lose his job. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And finally, FEMA travel trailers going to tribal members on the Turtle Mountain Reservation are intended for recreational use and not for housing purposes. Remember that, you Turtle Mountain Reservation members in North Dakota. You can play pool in the trailer, but don't you dare sleep in it now. It's got, you know what it's got on it. That's going to conclude this week's edition. It doesn't have Chinese drywall, we know that. That's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want, at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphones through Stitcher.com, available as a free download to members at audible.com/the show, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like hearing all the songs from the top if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All right, thank you very much. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks, and to my old pal David L. Lander, whom I kind of channeled today. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO. An email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music here on, always available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.